This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm here as usual with Martin. How are you, Martin?
I'm not too bad, Chris. How are you, mate?
Not bad, not bad. I hear that you're trying to start a revival of CPM.
I am. I bought myself a small CPM single board computer, or Z80 small single board computer. It runs CPM 2.2, CPM 3.0, Z80. It's got 128K.
Wow. Any applications?
Yeah, I've had a play with WordStar. Fantastic. That was quite interesting.
That's good. It's good to go a bit retro. You'd probably work better than Word.
Well, actually, it's very distraction-free. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot to it. I've also got Zork 1, 2, and 3 on it.
Superb.
Yeah.
It's good to do a bit of retro once in a while. Okay, anyway, enough of that. Enough of your little side projects. We're going to be talking today to Jim Walker, who's VP of Product Marketing at Cockroach Labs, makers of or developers of Cockroach DB, Jim.
That's right, Chris. Happy to talk to you guys. Good to meet you all.
Could you just give us a bit more detail, a bit more background? I mean, I've just said VP of Product Marketing. It doesn't say a lot. I guess you can fill that out a bit more for us.
Funny enough, I think when you have a marketing title, people often think it's not too technical. Actually, I started my career as a developer for quite some time, but, the role of product marketing, I always find to be one that is, undervalued sometimes, because I feel like we are translators from deep technical concepts into kind of more, business or I guess English is mm-hmm. what I think I'd like to translate it to, but American English for me, guys,
just English as we call it.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. For you all. Yeah. Right. So, but not the King's English, at least. That's what my role is. And I'm at Cockroach Labs. Yeah, we are the developers of Cockroach DB, a database that we've been building for about 6 years, 6.5 years or so. And, like the name, something that will scale out very easily, something that is highly resilient, survive the failure of a server or a rack or an AZ or a whole region, whatever you want to do. Fairly simply to configure, but more importantly, something that can scale from, a single data center problem to multiple data centers and even global. And dealing with kind of transactional workloads in a global environment is something that's pretty difficult to do. When you start to think about the speed of light, think about where are reads and writes coming into, and how do I locate data close to users? And that's something that we've taken on as a challenge, and we've built a database around that for transactional workloads.
Fantastic. Okay, so we're going to sort of, I guess, not major entirely on data and storage today. We're going to talk a bit more about the move from containers to serverless and how that all fits in. And obviously, you've got that sort of data angle in terms of the platform that you run and you support. We just thought it'd be nice just to do something slightly off base and talk a bit more about the serverless side of things, because I think it's an area that still for me is a little bit of a black hole, I guess, or a little bit of a black box, even whatever you want to call it. But I look at it and think I see the idea of it, the idea of running code remotely and being able to run code like that. There's lots of things around it I haven't quite got my head around, whether that's the storage, whether that's the security. And it'd be good to have a chat around that just to try and understand some of that. So that's our conversation for today. Why don't you, Jim, just start us off with that idea of where you think the transition's been over the last sort of 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, I thank you for actually saying the 5 to 10 to 15, Chris. I think that's actually right. And I think, this movement started with virtualization, right? It really did. And I think what we're seeing now is kind of the end of that, or at least the beginning of something else, maybe, right? Even, but I think, as we started to virtualize, we started to realize running these things at scale, but efficiently, running compute at scale efficiently was critical for organizations. And, we saw the buildup of VMware, and that's a multi-billion dollar company because, well, rightfully so, correct? And then we kind of saw this move towards containerization, where we really started to abstract out things in the development workflow so that, we can run these things everywhere. I honestly, you guys, love that it ended up being called containerization, because I have conversations about, if you look at like the past 50 years or even the last 80 years of what we've done as industrialists in terms of how we've changed the supply chain of our physical goods and what kind of the standardization on a container has meant for our world, just in general, right? think about the last 5 to 6 years and draw the same parallels to the changes into supply chain of software from, you know, the developer's fingers to, you know, my audience consuming this thing, and think of the effect of containers on what we've done over the last really 5 to 10 years. Phenomenal. Like the tools that have built up, the way that we even think about deployment of infrastructure. And then, you know, it kind of is this move towards orchestration of these things and in production, and this move towards Kubernetes that is kind of, you know, blowing up all over the place. I like to think of this as, you know, Google infrastructure for everyone else. There was the founder of CoreOS, which was one of these early days Kubernetes and container Linux companies. He came up with that term, Giphy, right? And I think we're kind of getting to that point. And I think, you know, ultimately it comes to how do you automate everything? And I think the ultimate end game here is this kind of serverless world, where serverless doesn't mean there's not servers, of course. Cloud doesn't mean it's just other people's servers. It's ultimately this level of automation that completely abstracts out that layer for the developer to a wholly other level. There's still going to be people involved, right? But it's how do you actually script and deal with all these things in that new world? Now, there's a whole lot of requirements that go into that. And you're right, Chris. It's there's networking, security, storage. Those complications there are just tremendous. So I think as a concept, we're there. Like the 15-year journey to get us to the point to where we're talking about these things, I think we're at the point where the next 10 years is going to be really interesting in terms of how far we go towards this serverless world. I mean, is it Lambda functions? Is it, you know, how does all this actually get managed? Are there standards? What are the APIs? Like, I think all that stuff still needs to be sorted out. But I'm excited about where it's going and some of the challenges actually in front of us.
Martin, I was thinking about this, and as inevitable when we have these conversations, my mind drifts back to mainframe land and thinks about, you know, how does this compare to what we used to do? And I was thinking about things like when we were running batch jobs with JCL, where things were abstracted from you, when you were running code that was written in something like COBOL, which you had fairly little or no idea of the underlying structure of anything that was there, and you're using pretty standard sort of calls in and out of things. Things were, I guess, to a certain degree, they were abstracted, actually, a bit like these, you know, where the aim for serverless is, but just weren't executed in the same way.
Yeah, but we didn't care back in the day really about the underlying infrastructure, did we? We just wrote code, compiled it, off you went. You didn't worry. These things were looked after by infrastructure teams, which is kind of where we've lived for a long time, Chris. But it was, and then when things started to move down into client server, Windows machines, desktop machines, people got a lot more excited about what the infrastructure was, what was underneath it. Realistically, in the past, we look at what we did dealt with in the mainframe, the developers really didn't care about things like availability, capacity planning. I'd argue they still don't, but it's outside of things. And it was really kept, the abstraction and orchestration was done by your mainframe.
Mm. I got into trouble a couple of times because in the mainframe world, I tended to write scripts that there's a language called Rex, if you know that at all, Jim. Restricted extended executor, a bit like a sort of scripting language. And I used to write code that would read an entire file into memory, and then it would process it, because I could see that the delay there was the I/O getting that data back and forth. So typically I just read the whole thing in and then just crunch the whole thing. And then I'd get a phone call from the operators going, your job's stuck, there's something wrong with it. I'm going, no, it's not. And they go, but it's using 100% CPU and doing no I/O. I said, yep, because it read it all into memory, because it's quicker. Oh, we shouldn't be doing that. You know, you get all that sort of people saying that to you. But the way you write stuff like that was, you know, dependent on understanding at least a little bit of how, you know, the system worked. And I'm not really sure how much of that goes on in serverless, is what I was going
to
say.
Yeah, I mean, I think the beauty there, Chris, is we're abstracted to one back end, right? Like we didn't have the complications of, you know, different cloud providers and different environments and all these different things. I mean, all you had was, you had an operator. Oh, you want to scale? Well, he was basically just running cables to another panel where he's pushing in cards, right? Like, and then shit, I'll just IPL the box and it just restarted. Great. Okay. Yep. You know, like that was pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, the infrastructure is just so complex now. And, you know, this is why we have things like Terraform. This is why we have companies trying to figure out a control plane across all these things. And how do you manage them at scale? It's just, and so I think the concepts are there. I think we're a long way from really abstracting that out to an efficient set of API that we can all code against and that we can all deploy against, honestly, because I think that's where we end up. That's where we want to be. Mainframe world is pretty simple. It was JCL and yeah, you had some smart people doing some cool stuff and people were confused, but you were taking advantage of what you had. You didn't have to do that three or four times, right, Chris? No. You had one to do it against, right? Like,
absolutely. Yeah, not entirely. So as we go back and look at the you know the way that we're heading, and I entirely agree. I think serverless sounds like the end game, in the sense that maybe it's not the end game. Maybe there is another step afterwards thinking about it. But it's on the towards the end game of saying code is the thing I want to execute, and I just want to see the result of that code, and I want that code to run when it needs to process some data, ultimately. I mean, that's what we're saying. We tend to put a lot of stuff in the background to sit and wait for that code to turn up, like, you know, databases and web servers that sit there waiting for that to happen. But a lot of that code could just be executed on demand. As I said just a few minutes ago, I'm not entirely sure I understand how some of those challenges around things like data and security are fixed. They seem to be, for me, still challenges.
Yeah. And they are. And if we're going to get to the end point where we deploy code in this serverless environment, what is that, you know, box the environment, Chris. And so how much of that is serverless? And so how do we need to rethink about secrets and security and certificates in a serverless type world? Is it like, you know, is it Vault? Is it that kind of model where we're kind of, you know, it is scalable. It is resilient, right? Like the core principles of this kind of distributed thinking and this distributed mindset have to be there. Like, and we're just at the point where the world is trying to learn that, right? And so, you know, you think about distributed systems and these protocols like Raft and Paxos, right? Mm-hmm. All of that stuff has to be redesigned first to employ that, like scale easy, be resilient, work everywhere, right? Like, and the CAP theorem is no joke. Like, we have to apply these principles to kind of all of our systems before we get to a full serverless world, because what's in that box has to all be serverless. Like, and I think there's step functions for us to get there. And I think there's pieces. I mean, for us, it's the database. I mean, you know, I mean, that's the world I live in. You know, I think the database should also be serverless. I don't think a developer should ever have to worry about operations. I want a SQL API in the cloud. I code against it. It's a REST interface. You deal with scaling the thing up and down. You deal with moving the data around the planet. So I have, you know, sub 50 millisecond latency access to that data. You deal with this whole like active, passive. What is that in a distributed world? You know what I mean? Like, and so like for the database, there's very discrete challenges that we're dealing with here, but I see them playing out in the other layers of the stack that actually need to be there for this full box to be delivered. I think, Chris, it's a good point. It's like, it's a flag right now. I think it's like, it's directionally correct, I think, if we think about it. I still think we're far from the end game here. And it's because of all these pieces have to be rethought, if you will, and re-architected.
Yeah. It makes sense, Martin, doesn't it? I mean, you just think about the choices we go through today before we even run a piece of code. Like, you know, what's it going to sit on? What type of storage do you want? Is it going to be fast or slow? What type of processor does it run on? Do you need it to run on, you know, a certain type of machine? Does it need an architecture that's ARM-based, or does it need one that's x86-based? We still put a lot of physical attributes in the way of running the code.
We do. It has become more abstracted, and databases is a really interesting one, because database, you could argue, has been abstracted for many, many years. You could just say you just talk to SQL API. You may have to hit a configuration point to get speed to a particular instance, but it's a really nice sort of place. Database as a service. Well, if you've got a well-running infrastructure, your database as a service is what way it should be. But when we start getting into the geo of scaling and global, that becomes much more challenging. And sometimes I wish developers didn't think quite so much about their SQL and do strange and wonderful things with it. But then again, we'd also like developers to think about their SQL so they don't run full table scans for no particular reason.
Yeah,
but we should be concentrating on the code side more than worrying about what's behind it. And then maybe they might do a better job of actually helping interact with the backend databases.
Yeah, so let's just think about that then. So abstraction of services, database seems a great one from a data perspective. Push all those responsibilities to somebody else. Just set a set of requirements and say it needs to scale, it needs to be reliable, it needs to be up, it needs to be accessible from, you know, certain places or whatever. And then you translate those into somebody else's job, like Jim and his team, to go and deliver. That's ultimately what we're saying. Why can't it be the same for everything? Why can't it be that for storage? Why can't it be that for networking? You know, are we on a journey to get to that point already? Can we see, you know, can we see evidence of that already happening?
We for sure, Chris. I mean, that's, and thank you for abstracting it out to us, because it's a lot of fun building these things too, y'all. Like, these are not simple challenges to deal with, right? And so when you talk about scale, Martin, you're saying, yeah, how do I abstract that away to a service? Sure, it's a service. I'm going to, right now it's vertical scale. You know, it's been lift and shift. You know, we've taken a backend, you know, database, we've run it in the cloud, and it's still running on an instance somewhere, and I could increase the size of that box, but what happens when I reach that upper limit? Now I'm sharding, and, you know, what if I need to shard more than once? Okay, then twice, three. Think about the operational complexity, the amount of people. I don't care if it's a service or not. The amount of people it takes to just manage that is enormous. And if you just think about the cost, it's ridiculous. And so just why not automate all that, right? Like, why not just let the thing do that? And I think that's just scale. Like, you know, if you think about it from a resilience point of view, what am I have active passive in two regions, and how do I set that up? And now I have asynchronous replication, and I have a, you know, RPO, RTO when things go down of say a minute or five, what happens in that 5 minutes of, you know, disparate two databases? And how do I, like, we're using legacy kind of like process and structure and framework in a modern world. And there's this kind of little bit of this impedance mismatch, right? It's not working out right. And so it's not lift and shift. It's not move and improve either. You don't take something and change a piece of it. You know, like AWS Aurora, right? They've changed the storage layer to be distributed. It's brilliant. Like, what they built is absolutely phenomenal, right? But it's just a bunch of Postgres instances on top of that, or MySQL, right? Sitting on top of distributed storage. What the failing there is, like, you don't have writes distributed. You know, like, you still have a single write node, so you need to scale that write node really far up. And so you still have these, like, the move and improve thing, you kind of got to re-architect from the ground up. And that's what I think the ultimate delivery of serverless, the ultimate delivery of kind of this Google infrastructure for everybody, I like to think about ultimately. I think that's where we're headed, right? That's where we end up. And what did they do? Well, they hire really crazy, ridiculously smart people from MIT and all these crazy places, and they dream up of all this great stuff, right? And it's re-architecting. It's building from scratch for what we're trying to accomplish. Because, yeah, that's the tough part.
Yeah, and it makes me think, just going off and thinking how that could even work, that as we think about it in terms of serverless compared to how we might write our applications and code previously, we depend on things like scale up, because the scale up keeps us in the consistency model. We know we've got one physical machine that's doing that scalability. And as it gets bigger, it's the single point of, as you said, Jim, writes, for example. So by not scaling out and having to keep those in sync as we scale out, that's an easier solution. But as we go and do more serverless, we don't want to have the understanding of things like the locking technique and the consistency built into the app. We just want the code to be able to go in and say query or write a new bit of data. So we're trying to extract some of that logic out of the code and push it into the infrastructure so that that code becomes super simplified and becomes easier to run and execute.
That's right. And I think that's, you know, coming back to kind of something you had touched on earlier too, Martin, let's let developers build business logic and let's us as infrastructure people build stuff that's going to do these things for them. You know, there's proven algorithms that kind of help you with these. You were talking about locking, Chris. Like, so we implement something called multi-version concurrency controls, right? So MVCC. Yeah, it's not simple to build. And it may be simple to build if it's like your undergraduate project and you have like a week to do it. Sure. But doing it for a production system is a wholly other thing. And the problem is all the corner cases. So I think there's pieces of the infrastructure that will be created by companies that focus on those things, right? And I think that's what I mean. And I love talking about security because it's another area, because what can go wrong will, right? And if you don't sort that out, you don't have a focus on that, and you leave it to the bespoke development teams to try to figure that out, it's going to fail. It's just going to fail. And so this kind of consolidation into kind of these components that abstract and all work together is what I believe needs to happen for us to successfully get to any point in time where we have true kind of serverless infrastructure. Because like I said, it's Murphy's Law, man. What can go wrong will. And unless you're focused on dealing with those things, I think abstracting it up to the expertise layers, I think is what's important here.
I guess as we think about this and we start to think how serverless might get delivered, what I think is really interesting is that there's two bits. There's the ecosystem that actually delivers the serverless functionality and how that integrates in. So how we actually build that, and we've just talked about some of that. And some of that is APIs and what APIs will be standardized. And looking back, picking the storage as an example, we all were not happy, but we sort of went along with the fact that Amazon was first in with S3 and everybody else has just basically followed along and said, okay, de facto-ish standards in the market. Are there any standards that exist so far with serverless to allow us to start building those API calls and doing that sort of stuff in code and making the code more portable?
Right now, the closest I have to any sort of standard from an API-based kind of model is the API that's been built up and around Kubernetes and the way that we think about that infrastructure. I think it's the closest to what the end game is. I think we're still far away. That luckily for us, Kubernetes was not just launched as an open source project, but was also launched with a large governing group around it, the CNCF, which has been very good about kind of governing where this direction goes. And I think that the technical oversight, the committee, the TOC does a good job of maintaining and managing, a great API for for Kubernetes, and it's working, but I still think we're far away. And I think that having the governing committee is the key thing here, y'all. I mean, I think S3 is a really good example, Chris, because they just basically had momentum and y'all had to follow, right? Like, it's just how it works. Like, but if you look back to, I think the greatest example of, a common API that fueled an industry where a lot of people came together is the whole concept of, global ATMs in financial services. Do you really think Citibank had their own little like thing going on, and then all the other banks came together and they were like, oh, great, we got to go to their standard. They all stood to make money, right? And so it's going to be a very interesting 10 years as, the large public cloud providers coalesce around some sort of standard of what this needs to be, because that's ultimately what has to happen for these things to happen, because you need the portability. The lock-in is a thing. I don't think it's about lock-in. I think it's about freedom. People want freedom to do what they need to do. And I think that will ultimately kind of see where we go. I think we're a far way away from anything even remotely close to that, because they're all just building up their own kind of services or serverless services. Yeah, yeah.
Isn't this natural, Martin? I mean, you want to land grab, if you like. And you want to go out there and say, well, I'm going to set my stall out and say, this is what my standard's going to be. I mean, we saw that at every aspect of infrastructure. We see that at the storage layer. We see it at everything where somebody goes out and says, well, this is the standard I'm going to set. And they hope that their standard will be the one that everybody adopts.
Really, it's a concept of embrace and extend, embrace a standard and extend it. I'm sorry, actually, Amazon have been really interesting on S3. I was really worried about it becoming a de facto standard, but actually they've been pretty good custodians of it. I hope they learned quite a lot from Microsoft, because Microsoft had a real go at messing up SMB and SIFs. Mm-hmm. And they eventually came for a party with Samba, and they begin to understand, you're right, Jim, you make money. Standards will enable you to make money. It reduces the friction. You're going to need standard APIs for things like serverless, because otherwise you're not going to get the developers. You want as many developers as possible. The developer's going to have to learn half a dozen or a dozen different serverless APIs. It's going to make it very difficult for everybody, and it's probably not going to allow the state-of-the-art to accelerate in the way you want it to do. Let's forget about API wars. So let's get it into standards. I'm probably not a big fan of putting it into a standards body either, because as soon as we get it into a standards body, that will just get bogged down. We know that. We've seen it in our standards body, Chris, with SNEA.
Oh, you're not kidding. Useless. I'm sorry, not particularly proactive, shall we say. Yeah, they've not really helped us in any way. It goes into a mire of too many. I don't know whether this is just typical across the whole industry. I don't think it is particularly, because the NVMe protocol seems to have done quite well. But the stuff that's come out of SNEA just seems to me to get mired into being too academic in terms of the way it's developed. You look at it and it's like it's impossible to read or consume. There's no way of easily picking it up and going, okay, I get what that is. And they try to basically boil the ocean with every standard they ever create, rather than just taking a step back and thinking, as long as the structure of the standard looks right, we can add the other bits in afterwards. We don't have to try and boil the ocean day one. I think maybe that makes them difficult to be adopted because they're not consumable. Whereas with S3 is relatively straightforward to pick up and just run a bit of code. You know, you can put it into something like Postman, or you can put it into all sorts of different tools, or even you could just use curl and just do it, and it would work fine. It wasn't difficult to do. And I think that's part of the challenge that you're right, we're going to see. And I really hope that we do get that sorted, but it's going to be a challenge, definitely.
Well, guys, I'm interested to see what is the role of, you know, the community in standards groups. Sorry. You know, do standards groups even need to be there, or do open source communities basically rule all and say, look, at this is the way that things are going to go because there's mass adoption and mass momentum, and how big you build a community and momentum around that. I'm a big open source person. I've been in this game for a while, and I've seen really great tech not win because of not having momentum behind a community. And it's unfortunate, but it's true. And I think it's another kind of one of these changing dynamics is, you know, the world has shrank. We don't have, you know, the standards bodies, you know, demanding that everybody do anything anymore. We have this kind of grounds up, you know, community-based organic build out of a standard, which I think is going to be interesting. And I think it's not just the standard as the API to the developer, Martin. It's also the API between all the pieces that have to come together to make this work, right? And that's where it's going to get really interesting. And I think we're just starting that journey now.
So it's fascinating you say that, Jim, because it made me think of the initial containerization movement when we had Docker come along. And I think that just sort of re-energized everybody's sort of thought around the concept of it, or rather than necessarily all developing all of it from scratch. But the container runtime, the container engines all got a bit messy. There was a number of different solutions out there, and there was Rocket and there was Docker sort of slightly competing against each other. But finally, somehow, they did sort of find a common ground, and some degree of common ground was established. I'm not sure whether that's entirely resolved, but at least it did sort of get a bit further on than just having them all sitting out there and having to support all the different flavors of it.
Yeah, you know, I was kind of in the middle of that a bit. You know, again, at CoreOS, we had Rocket, and I thought Rocket was absolutely brilliant. And
I was setting you up slightly there, by the way.
Thank you. You know, some of the concepts there live forward in Creo and what's happening at Red Hat. And it's the companies like Red Hat that get this, mm-hmm. right? Like they fundamentally get it at the core of who they are as a company that are going to help drive those things. And they're a wonderful open source company. I mean, talk about, you know, even in the context of IBM now, you know, I think with where they fit in and kind of them actually helping to drive a lot of the bigger strategy now, it's almost the tail wagging the dog a little bit in that one now. They still get it. And I think we're starting to see kind of things coalesce around a real good standard there, because it was a bit slippery there for a while. And I think there were different parts of the community, you know, pulling and pushing in different directions. It was all after the same game, right? Like, how do we make this stuff simple in containers? I mean, Solomon and team had their own idea, and of course they've got to come out with, you know, what they thought was going to be right. But, yep. You know, kudos to Solomon and Docker and everything that happened there, because, you know, we took something called namespaces and made something product, and now Docker Compose, and, you know, it's on the desktop of every single person, and it's right, and it works, and it's amazing, right? And it took a little bit of a company to make that happen, you know, and I think that's where this balance of open source and enterprise and kind of these things kind of do come together, because it does make certain things happen.
Absolutely. And I don't want to go off at a tangent, but I think people perhaps think that Docker was a failure because the company itself has sort of shrunk and, you know, split into two bits and sort of bit by bit being subsumed by Kubernetes. But I don't necessarily think that's true. I think without some of the ideas that they came up with around things like the way that you could package applications and you could execute them and you could manage that code, if we didn't have all of that, as well as the changes in the Linux operating system to make it work, if we didn't have that, we wouldn't be where we are today with everything else. So, you know, it's almost sort of a requirement, isn't it, Martin?
Well, is it kind of unfortunate in some ways that companies can be technically very successful, but commercially the exit isn't there for them? And that happens. As you say, the best technology doesn't always win. The best technology sometimes wins, but doesn't actually make anybody any money out of it either. And it's just unfortunate situation. I mean, we can look all the way back to Linux. You can still get people who tell you that Linux is not the best operating system and BSD should have won. But it doesn't matter. It did.
Yeah, well, there's people who tell you Windows is an acceptable operating system.
But it is, Chris.
And OS 2 isn't.
It is? Wait a second, I'm sorry. What What am Windows I on is, here?
Like, Windows is an acceptable desktop operating system.
Acceptable.
Chris T.C. on is on macOS. He's an acceptable desktop operating system.
Neither
of them are great.
Yeah, I just don't like the fact that Windows went into the data center in the place where it had absolutely no right to be. But that's a story for another day, without a doubt.
We can talk about how Windows in the data center changed the paradigm of servers in a data center at some point. That's an interesting discussion.
And it could also have led to the success of VMware to a certain degree as well, because obviously it was hideously inefficient. So consolidating it down onto a single physical server actually made it more efficient. But maybe VMware should thank Microsoft for making such a hash of the way that they built Windows for the data center. There we are. I've said it. Okay, we're supposed to be, to a certain degree, talking about data here, and I guess I would like to sort of drag it back to a discussion of how we see that going. So over the years, as we've moved away from physical servers where the storage was pretty obviously connected directly to the server, or even with SANs where it just looked like it was directly connected to the server but was consolidated, the VMware idea virtualized the storage as well as virtualizing the application. And with containers, I don't think we've really seen a really good final solution for how storage is going to work. And it makes me wonder whether we're going to have the same issue with serverless, because we're even more abstracted from the infrastructure. So I wonder whether we need to start stepping back and not thinking about the traditional protocols and start thinking more of data protocols than storage protocols. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I completely agree with that, Chris. And I think we're going to end up in a world where different workloads will demand different storage, right? Like, and I think, it's going to be a choice. You know, in the serverless world, is it just a set of, checkmark boxes and dials and levers and stuff that you can pull to basically make it right for whatever that is? And this is what I was talking about earlier as well. We were talking about APIs and these sort of things. It's like, well, we need a consistent API for all of them, so any one of them would plug in. And it's this whole kind of Lego block plug and play, but configurable for the end users. I sense where this is all going to end up. I was kind of deep in the Kubernetes thing, and the constructs of the storage class in Kubernetes and persistent volumes and PVCs, persistent volume claims, and being able to mount any type of storage is right. It works pretty well. We deal with it all the time within our implementations, right? I mean, if you want distributed storage, okay, hook Rook up to it. And there's an operator that just actually deals with, hooking up Rook and dealing with all these things. If you want to just mount a simple device, it's pretty simple and straightforward, right? But there's options. And it comes back to having this kind of this API to deal with these different layers. But the problem early days was it was a horribly documented API. And it was really difficult. So it's going to come back to how well we can communicate as humans, so that the communications as machines is methodical and structured and correct and, as expected as it's going to be. I don't know where it ends, Chris, but I presume ultimately in the end, it's knobs and dials and whatnot that we're tuning, and the back end is dealing with this. Again, I don't know how many times, there's a lot to do between then and now, though.
Yeah. I don't know about you, Martin. I look at it and think, if you think about basic IO instructions, I'm trying to go too deep here, but you think about the idea of how you access a file. You open the file, you write to the file, you can seek and move around in a file, and you close the file. With an object interface, you retrieve the object or you write the object. I mean, it's basically CRUD, or your four activities you can do. I think with serverless, we need to move more towards that sort of model of, we need function calls for data, not IO instructions. And there need to be function calls that say, I want to store and retrieve this object, this table, this row, this whatever it happens to be, not continuing to think about blocks. And that should be at another layer.
Oh, I completely agree, Chris. And I actually think this is a big paradigm shift for developers in general, is actually to start thinking it. You're not thinking about a file IO as such anymore. You're going to have to change that. So all these libraries you're used to using, forget about those. Actually, your life's just become a lot easier. You create a file, you read a file, you update a file, or you might, if you're very good, delete it once in a while. Almost forget about delete. Nobody deletes anything these days.
No, you don't need to worry about that. Somebody will archive it for you. That's what Amazon's for. That's what S3's for, isn't it? Just archive it away. But say, from your perspective, Jim, in the serverless world, you would have to offer some sort of function library for that code to be able to execute. And I don't know whether it should be, because I don't know enough about the serverless model, I don't know whether that serverless model should say that there should be a standard database query or functions or queries, and then you plug into that in the serverless infrastructure and say we're a provider of that infrastructure. A bit like CSI says, you know, you want a block device and all these block devices are available. How does it, do you know how it works today? And you know, do you have any opinion about how it should work?
Yeah, we have a pretty opinionated model on how this works. And ultimately, you know, what does a serverless database look like? You know, there is an API, it's called SQL. Like, you know, that is the syntax, right? And so let's just make it really easy. Let's just use what is the standard. But, you know, when you get into distributed systems, you know, if I'm going to insert 10,000 records into a table, well, on a single stack box, like that was a pretty simple thing to, the database would just, you know, optimize that. But when you get into distributed execution and you have, you know, 100 nodes all working on the insert 10,000 records, maybe you want to break that up into 10 insert statements, you know? And so are there going to be abstractions that actually help us kind of load balance those sort of things? I think we'll see some of that kind of emerge in the SQL syntax over time as people get more into kind of distributed thinking. But I think ultimately what it comes down to, if you think about each node being a participant in a database, right? Like as a single logical database, you know, deployed over, you know, 100 nodes or whatever that is across the whole planet, and they're all coordinated and dealing with each other and moving data close to the end user, that's a critical capability of something being distributed, by the way. The physical like location of data is so incredibly important because the speed of light is no joke. Mm-hmm. I think you're never gonna beat that, right? Like, well, if we do in my lifetime, great, because I want to see what happens. Because that's gonna be an interesting day. But like, so latencies are you know you're dealing with these things that are not easy to overcome. You have to do that. But in order to do that, every node has to look alike. And so for us, our opinion is that every node of the database, which is accepting reads and write, executing queries across the distributed network, typically will implement the same piece of storage because if, like, from a distributed systems point of view, when you scale, you don't want to scale different types of nodes. Like, I don't need like heavy storage node, light storage node. Like, I just want one node, and I want to put that in container, and I want, and that's ease of scale. Mm-hmm. And so when people start thinking about, you know, the development of distributed systems, you know, I always tend to think about abstracting out kind of an atomic unit of capability into one unit. And making sure that happens, because that's going to simplify the deployment. Right now, when I deploy, I spin up a pod, throw Kubernetes on it. Throw CockroachDB on it. It mounts the same volume. Great, I'm good. Like I don't have like 15 different types. Like simplifying that down to kind of one stack of each piece, and then scaling out each piece. That's distributed mindset. Like that's thinking about things in a way that will get to a point where we now have, how do you scale from 100 to thousands? I don't have different operational model to maintain each node either, right? I have one runbook, pretty simple, right? And I think that's the trick, and that's, you know, that's our opinionated view of how this actually works out for us.
Mm. So here's one thought, Martin. You know, we talk a lot about data mobility, and there's an assumption, you know, can't beat the speed of light and all that sort of stuff. You kind of break the laws of, or you kind of beat the laws of physics, or break the laws of physics, whatever Scotty used to say. If you look at the way we design stuff today, we try to create islands of applications and data and then somehow try and work out how we join them together in such a way that allows them to be distributed. But actually, maybe the answer is to take the data out of that infrastructure so that it becomes a service call that any type of platform can make. So for instance, a serverless bit of code can do it, a container can do it, a physical server can do it, a virtual machine can do it, and they call the same thing. And it's the thing that's the abstraction that you've taken out of all of those things. So now you don't have to move stuff around. You've abstracted the data into one place where you can make that call.
Yeah, you should obviously sat in some workshops I sat in recently.
Really? It just seems logical after I had a conversation, really.
Building unified service tiers for storage. And so you just, anything can talk to Alera, and it doesn't have to know where anything is. There are some there are some interesting problems with latency and where data is and things like that. And you need to have some kind of way of an application being told, for instance. I mean, some of it comes down to our old problem of HSM, for instance. You ask for a piece of data and it's not actually there. You're going to have to wait for it. So how does an application cope with that? But actually the piece of data you wanted was actually being aged off into a different tier of storage. So it's just a different type of latency. It's, so there are some development challenges for people to deal with. But yeah, it just becomes a uniform tier. Give me that, or I'm going to write that. I'm going to update that. And you shouldn't care anymore.
I think that's really interesting, Martin, isn't it? Because then you start to think about how many of these things can now become services, which, you know, is definitely more practical when you've got the abstraction of the application on different platforms. And clearly, Jim, that's where your company is headed. So do you want to spend just a minute or two, fill us in a bit more on exactly what it is you're developing?
Yeah, I mean, it just fits very well. And I think, Martin, you're exactly right in a lot of the things that you're talking about. And it comes back to something that I was talking about before, and it's like this, you know, take 80 years of our, you know, physical goods supply chain being broken down into kind of the assembly line and all these. That's exactly what's happening. And, you know, I love that the conversation, Chris, has kind of turned into like this conversation about APIs, because that's what's going to fuel this stuff. But there's a consumption problem here. And I think that's where things are going to get really interesting, because we still have to consume these things as services, and they do not, serverless or not, right? Like, and they aren't simple to do, right? There's a lot of challenges in front of us. We deal with this all the time. You know, we're building a database that, yeah, we want, you know, endpoints around the entire planet with, you know, guaranteed sub 50 millisecond access to data, no matter where it lives, and scale, and how big do you, is it always on, all this stuff, like all the beauty of CockroachDB in a serverless mode. But well, that's going to make us do things like, well, this thing needs to be multi-tenant. How do you do that, right? Like, how do you deal with the challenges of spinning things up and spinning down? Because I don't want to have to pay for backend infrastructure where nobody's using that instance of that service, right? So like this dormant service thing, the dormant database that we're going to have to deal with, we have to deal with that, right? But most importantly, you know, how do you get to consumption-based pricing? And so there's a whole other side of this, y'all, where the rating engine becomes a real big problem too, right? And you know, we talk about APIs, we talk about some sort of consistent standard to actually do all these things. Well, what happens when we get to a truly service world where, you know, one service in GCP is talking to a service in Amazon because we do have the right API, right? And you know, these are some of the things that are going to be really interesting. You know, for us, we're going to contain it into one single environment so we can actually, you know, deal with all these things. You know, we can control IOPS, we can control storage, we can control these dormant things, right? But for us, it really gets delivered in our ultimate vision, which is a truly global and serverless database. I don't care how big your application is. It doesn't matter. It's all going to be consumption-based. And I think if we think about these things from the consumer point of view, I think that's where things will start making sense. You know, here at Cockroach Labs, like, we're building a database that's truly serverless. And, you know, for us to do that, we had to think about a lot of different challenges. And if you think about serverless, what does it mean to be multi-tenant, right? What does it mean to spin services up and down based on how often they're being used? You know, how do I make a dormant database, but it comes back up in sub-millisecond, right? Like, those are big challenges to go out and deal with. But I think the biggest challenge is going to be consumption-based pricing and rating and how people get charged for these things. Because ultimately, it's the lens of the person that's consuming this stuff that's the most important for all of us. I think everything we talked about, Martin, we talked about APIs and being open, so all this stuff is going to come together. But, well, there's got to be an API for consumption here too, because these things cost money. Like, this, it's not just running on free machines somewhere. And so when this all comes together, what's the ultimate then bill for the end consumer based on all these different components? And I think that's going to be the biggest challenge of all of this, but I look forward to it all getting solved because it's the most efficient way to move forward.
Yeah. Any final thoughts, Martin?
That's an interesting point. And we've talked briefly about this in the past, sir, Chris, about FinOps. We think FinOps is going to become more and more important for everybody who works in IT. We're going to have to learn how to manage this. And there's going to be some APIs. You're right. There's going to need to be APIs, which allow us to get the financial information out. You may even want to be able your ability to tell your provider, well, this is my budget, this is what I can spend. And as soon as I go over that, you stop doing this, because that's a problem with serverless. I know people have had serverless applications run away with them, expecting to deal with a few hundred or a few thousand transactions in next 3 years, because they don't actually have to think about how they scale it. because it just scales. We're suddenly dealing with 50, 60, 70, 80, 100,000. And their code works at that level. They've never had to deal with that problem before.
Yeah. Okay, great conversation, guys. Thanks very much for your time. Jim, it's been really interesting. Where should we point people to go and look at Cockroach Labs and CockroachDB?
Yeah, thank you, Chris. So it's just cockroachlabs.com. They can get started on a cluster, cloud consumption model, of course. I mean, that's how people want to consume. So you can get up and running on a version of us pretty quickly. But yeah, then you know what? I always direct people towards our docs. I think our docs are incredible. And I you know, kind of proud of them. So if you're ever interested in how to build a distributed system, man, there's some really good stuff in our documentation.
Fantastic. Okay. Cool. Thanks, Jim. It's been great to talk to you, and look forward to catch up with you in the future and talk a bit more about serverless and distributed databases.
Thank you, guys. I'm happy. That was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.